Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, John Lawrence, is a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. And his latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, John. And today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, both were reelected to their positions, which they've held. And Kevin McCarthy is now the minority head of the House. So now it remains to be seen what happens with Nancy Pelosi and a number of Democrats who were elected, of course, ran against her, in effect, or repudiated her. Seth Moulton from Massachusetts has already sort of laid down a marker against her. Since you know her very well, what's your sense of where things stand?
I think that things now are a little bit different than they were on the campaign trail. I think people are coming into Washington. They are going to be meeting with Mrs. Pelosi, but also with prospective committee chairmen, with the senior members of their delegation, with other members of the leadership. And I think there'll be a different kind of a conversation that takes place about the type of leadership that the party needs going forward on January the 3rd. We're going to go right into some very important legislation, some very important confrontations potentially with the president, with the Senate, which remains, of course, in Republican hands. And I think that increasingly the case will be made to people that this speakership is not an on-the-job training exercise. You need somebody there who is going to be experienced. And I note, incidentally, that Seth Moulton, the Massachusetts congressman that you mentioned, is quoted today in the paper as saying that to be an effective speaker, you have to be very good at the sort of transactional inside politics and understanding. And Pelosi is great at that. So even the critics are saying Pelosi is great at the exact and the precise qualities that are required of a Speaker of the House.
But of the 53 newly elected Democrats, only seven have said they would definitely vote for Nancy Pelosi. That's according to an analysis by The Fix.
Well, of course, you know, the members rightly are going to wait to come into town and talk about what their needs are, what their aspirations are, what they would like in terms of committee assignments. And it's understandable that many of them who have never met Mrs. Pelosi or met the people who are going to be their colleagues are going to withhold making any public commitment until they've had that opportunity. But they're going to have that opportunity. Today, Mrs. Pelosi met with the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group that has some ideas for changing the House rules. She's going to meet with members individually. She sponsored a dinner last night, I believe. And that is the normal process that takes place as people become acclimated to the realities of the Hill and the realities of serving in Congress. And one of those is that you need proven and trusted leadership. You know, one of the things that's very different now, as opposed to the class that I wrote about in my book, The Class of 74, these members who are coming into town, they don't have any policy disagreements, for the most part, with our leadership or with the Democratic Party, as they did in 1974 when the leadership was very conservative and very resistant. This is a leadership that's very much in keeping with the new members on health care, on infrastructure, on the need to reform campaign finance laws, immigration laws. So there's not that kind of resistance. And I think the more they talk to people, the more they'll get to know them and they'll recognize the need for having that kind of proven leadership at the helm.
But John Lawrence, isn't it difficult, though, to expect these new Congress people who have distanced themselves from Nancy Pelosi during the campaign to take their first vote and vote for her? Wouldn't they get backlash from their constituents? Wouldn't they be out of the gate, the very first vote being a repudiation of their stance?
Well, the first vote will actually be taken in a caucus meeting. And that's where the Democrats will decide who their candidate for speaker is going to be. And that vote is going to occur in late November. So that the speaker vote on the floor won't occur until January. So if there are people who, after these discussions and after these meetings, and remember, they had none of this beforehand when they were talking about these issues on the campaign trail. Now they will have actually met with people who will explain to them what the agenda is going to be, how their organization is going to proceed, where they're going to be located in committees, and lots of issues that they didn't have to deal with as candidates. But if there are some people who disagree after all those conversations, they will certainly have the opportunity to vote against Mrs. Pelosi, just as they said they would on the campaign trail when the Democratic caucus meets. But once the Democratic caucus reaches a decision, as to who their candidate is going to be, I think there's some expectation that people then stick with the caucus. I mean, what are they going to do, go to the floor and vote for the Republican?
Right.
You know, that's the Democratic caucus's position. And there are times, not many, but there are times, when you're called upon on procedural votes or key votes to stick with the Democratic caucus because that is in the party's interest and that's what the majority of your colleagues have agreed to do. So they will have a chance to vote against her if they want, but once the caucus makes that decision, if that decision is for Mrs. Pelosi, I would expect most of those members would then ratify the Democratic caucus's point of view, because it's at that point it's ratifying the caucus. It's not simply their own personal perspective.
But a recent poll by Monmouth finds that just under 3 in 10 Democrats approve of Pelosi's job performance as the party's minority leader in the House. So how is that going to affect the representatives if the grassroots, if you will, are opposed to Pelosi? And I don't know how much they're opposed based upon the relentless attacks on her by the Republicans. It's hard to know, but that's not a good sign, is it? Only 3 in 10 Democrats approving of her performance?
Well, I guess a couple of points. Number one, you mentioned at the top that Senator McConnell and Senator Schumer were just reelected. I think their popularity is actually lower than Mrs. Pelosi's, certainly right around the same level. I think part of the problem here is that most voters don't really know a great deal about what the actual members do and what the actual leaders do. And so they're very heavily influenced by what others say. You know, the Republicans have spent over a decade, have run over 100,000 negative campaign commercials and tens of millions of dollars castigating Mrs. Pelosi. I don't think Mrs. Pelosi's run a single ad supporting her. So naturally, I don't think it's terribly surprising that public opinion would be weighted in that particular direction. I think it's much more significant that independent analysts who look at the Congress, people like Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, is a very highly respected political scientist, say that she is the most effective speaker that we've had in the last 75 years. And as I say, even Seth Moulton said she's really great at the exact job that she's being called upon to serve as a Speaker of the House. So I think that those, you know, people who really pay close attention, even critics, acknowledge her enormous success in passing laws like the health care law and passing laws like reining in Wall Street abuses and saving the economy from collapse and providing jobs through the stimulus. Those folks who have followed her career are very aware of this seminal role and the leadership role that she has played as Speaker.
And what role is age playing in this, given that Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Jim Clyburn are all in their 70s and they've been leading the caucus for more than 15 years? And as far as I know, there aren't any succession plans, and that would seem to be something that the Democrats should be addressing.
Well, in point of fact, if you look beneath those three positions, and actually there is a challenge to Mr. Clyburn for the whip position, there's a whole litany, there are 7 or 8 additional leadership positions, the caucus chair, the caucus vice chair, the assistant leader, the campaign chair, the campaign messaging chair, the new members representative on the leadership. All of those positions are up for election as well. All of them are being contested, and almost everybody who's on that list of contestants is a junior member, 4 terms, 5 terms at the most. So there is a succession. It is not a succession that the speaker or the leader determines. She or he does not decide who the next person in line is. The caucus does. The caucus votes for these positions. So the Democratic speaker, the Democratic leader, doesn't choose her successor any more than the outgoing president chooses the nominee of the party. That doesn't work that way. It's up to the caucus. But I think what people can be confident about is that next generation of people, and Mrs. Pelosi has talked about her speakership, her forthcoming speakership, as a transitional one, that next generation is going to be in place. It's going to be voted on in the next 2 weeks. And I think it will be very clear by the time you get to January 3rd, when the speaker decision is made, that there is a new generation of Democratic leaders ready to take up the responsibilities when this current group is finished.
So let's talk about your new book, John Lawrence, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. When you talk about the roots of partisanship, and of course a lot of people are making comparisons to this blue wave election, which is a sort of blue wave that looked like a bit of a ripple, but now it's actually turned into a wave, and every day we find out more.
Every day, yeah.
More and more. There's just a couple here in Orange County that have looks like the Democrats have picked up seats.
Yes.
And there's a very good article recently by McKay Coppins, I think, in The Atlantic, about Newt Gingrich, the title of which is The Man Who Broke Politics. And he basically pins the beginning of this rabid partisanship and tribalism, as it's called now, in our politics. He traces it to Newt Gingrich, who deliberately blew up the comity that existed back in those days when Republicans and Democrats knew each other, their wives knew each other, they had dinners together, they played golf together, etc. So in that context, how much do you feel that the class of 74 contributed to, as you say in the title, subtitle, Roots of Partisanship?
Yeah, I think my argument is less that the class caused or contributed to it, but that the reforms that were implemented with the support of the class of 74, which basically decentralized power in Congress and gave greater ability for individual members and subcommittees to participate, created a Congress that was less leadership dominated, also opened opportunities for what were emerging divisions in American society, in American culture, in American politics, in American financial interests with respect to campaign financing, to take root and to force debates that formerly had been largely suppressed, were now given opportunities to get into the House and the Senate and become very, very contentious issues. I think that the argument that was made about Gingrich is puts the onset of partisanship probably a decade and a half later than it really is. You have to look, as my book does, to the mid-1970s, when you have very significant divisions occurring, partly as a result of the growth of the Republican Party in the South following the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-60s, really changing demographics, the emergence of independent money, the rise of new technologies that allow for ideologically based media and press coverage that really force people, in what political scientists say, into realignment. The Democrats become more liberal, the Republicans be more conservative, and as they say in Texas, there's not much left in the middle of the road other than a yellow line and a dead armadillo. But that process really begins back in the 1970s. Gingrich is very good at throwing gasoline into the fire, and he certainly exacerbates this problem with his emphasis on divisive language and lack of compromise, because he sees the possibility of Republicans gaining the majority, but only if people clearly differentiate Republicans from Democrats, and he sets about to do that by demonizing Democrats. Democrats provide him with some good ammunition for doing that, and by the late 1980s, that is where our politics has gone. But if you look to that later period, without really seeing how these issues and these trends emerged in the 70s, you're missing an important part of the story, which is what I try to tell in this book.
So just back to the comparisons of this being like the class of 74 in terms of a huge influx of young and largely progressive Democrats, How is Nancy Pelosi going to navigate this concern that she clearly has that she doesn't want the new Democratic House right out of the gate talking about impeachment? She feels, well, I can tell, that the Democrats have to prove to the American people that they're not the wrecking crew, but they have a positive agenda. And obviously, fundamentally, the fact that they got elected would indicate that the American people want a check and balance on Trump, because the Republican House and Senate have been completely derelict in exercising their constitutional powers as a separate branch of... They've been the enablers of the wrecking crew, to put it bluntly.
I don't think there's any question that you're exactly right. The Congress has literally failed in its responsibility both to legislate and therefore enabling the president to impose sweeping policy changes through executive actions. And then they failed to conduct adequate oversight, which is their constitutional responsibility, to investigate how those decisions were made and whether or not they're in keeping with the spirit and the letter of the law. So they failed on both accounts. I think that impeachment is going to probably be off the table in the same way that Mrs. Pelosi took it off the table when she became Speaker in 2007. There were a lot of people at that point, for example, who wanted her to initiate impeachment hearings of President Bush over the decision to go to war in Iraq. And she made the case that we had more important priorities than that. And she set about dealing with the economy and dealing with energy policy and dealing with health care and others. I think this time the incoming class, interestingly, ran very much on issues that speak to traditional Democratic policy objectives: health care, protecting Social Security, Medicare, fixing the DREAM Act and the DACA students and immigration, addressing climate change, fixing the Voting Rights Act. These are these incoming members from urban, suburban districts, moderate districts, liberal districts, they all pretty much agree on those issues. And I think Mrs. Pelosi will recognize, and I think most Democrats will recognize, that voters sent people to Washington to deal with those issues and not to become bogged down in partisan fighting. Having said that, I think that Democrats will simultaneously begin serious investigations and oversights, not necessarily into the impeachment question, but into questions of how did the president make decisions to weaken the Affordable Care Act, to expand the amount of mercury that could be released into the air and into the water, to weaken mileage standards, to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, and a host of other executive level decisions that he has been able to make and that the Congress has not batted an eye about. Now I think those people who made those decisions, whether it's in EPA or whether it's in the Department of Health and Human Services or in the White House for that matter, are going to be called to the Congress, and they're going to be asked to produce the information and the data that justifies these really sweeping changes in policy that the Congress has never voted on and that the Congress has never investigated. And if those officials of the Trump administration refuse to produce that information, then you'll be looking at subpoenas, and properly so. They don't have the authority to simply tell Congress they won't produce that information. But I don't think that'll be the first line of inquiry. I think they will first meet with people, tell them, we want to see, come down, we want to see where your information comes from on all these radical changes that the president has been able to make on public laws, and hopefully hold them accountable for those kinds of decisions.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure to talk with you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. And his latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.